and welcome to Power Problems, a podcast from the Cato Institute where we offer a skeptical take on U.S. foreign policy and discuss some of today's big questions in international security with guests from across the political spectrum. I'm Emma Ashford. Welcome to the third and final episode in our series on the world after coronavirus. Over the last few episodes, we've talked about the economy and the defense budget, but it's the topic of great power politics, particularly the rise of China, that's been getting the most discussion in recent months. China's response to the pandemic has been widely viewed as more effective than America's, leading many to question whether our lackluster response highlights a declining American state, or whether just democracies in general have done more poorly than autocracies in responding to the virus. The coronavirus has also prompted a new wave of anti-Chinese actions from the Trump administration, whether it's referring to COVID-19 as the China virus or pulling out of the World Health Organization, the White House's strategy appears to be to avoid blame by pinning the virus on China. It's wag the dog, pandemic style. So joining me today to discuss U.S.-China relations, what the coronavirus can tell us about power, and whether we're headed into a conflict with China is Josh Schifrinson. Josh is an assistant professor of international affairs at Boston University. Welcome back to Power Problems, Josh.
Thanks, Emma. It's wonderful to be here and be back.
Yeah, so you joined us a little over a year ago to talk about great power politics, right about the time your book came out. And I think we can all agree that a lot has changed since that time. So I guess let's just start with, you know, are the US and China in a worse place than they were a year ago? From your point of view, what's changed?
Well, it's hard to say they're in a worse place than a year ago. I think what has happened over the last year is some of the underlying tensions and fissures between the U.S. and China have really come to the surface. They've been made much more overt. They've been brought into sharper relief. And insofar as public tensions are worse than private ones, then maybe we're in a worse position. And certainly, COVID, coronavirus, and the economic and geostrategic fallout from that is exacerbating problems. I have a hard time saying worse or better. Let me just say that the tensions are more overt and the rhetoric is much sharper.
That does seem to be sort of a feature at the moment, is the rhetoric has got really bad on both sides. You know, we've got Chinese officials sending out tweets talking about, you know, how terrible the US government is. We've got the Trump administration, as I said in the intro, repeatedly referring to this as a sort of a China virus and trying to pin the blame on Beijing so that they don't have to sort of take any account for their own failures. And it just seems like we've entered a phase of relations where both sides kind of believe that they can deflect from their own problems by focusing on the other side.
I think that's 100% right. And by the way, I don't think this is just about a coronavirus response. I think in general, U.S. and Chinese leaders have found political reasons of their own, both related to and separate from coronavirus, for really exacerbating tensions. I think on the U.S. side, this really helps justify, it gives the U.S. a sense of international purpose, which I think Trump wants because of accusations of drifting leadership. The Democrats want to hang around the neck of the Trump administration. And I'm not a China expert, but I could imagine numerous reasons why a new generation of foreign policymakers and increasingly nationalistic elites in the PRC are turning to international tensions to mobilize support. So I think this is a perfect storm of elite opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be that the coronavirus is more sort of a scapegoat than anything else. So a lot of people are implying that declining U.S.-China relations are the result of the coronavirus. Putting aside all the conspiracy theories about it was grown in a Chinese lab, and you know that experts have basically said aren't even remotely reasonable. But there seems to be, I think, a perception on the part of a lot of elites in Washington that the coronavirus is sort of the last straw. You know, the relations have been getting worse with Beijing for quite some time, and that this is sort of the last straw, and now we're going to engage in a more confrontational relationship.
Yeah, I think your point is very well taken. You know, it's the straw that broke the camel's back. But I also want to build on that point, because I think the coronavirus is really much more symbolic and not itself causal. right? In Mark Trachtenberg's wonderful book, A Constructed Peace, he has a chapter on the ultimate collapse of U.S.-Soviet relations called Crossing the Rubicon. And I think that's exactly right. You could do a similar analogy here, where if we didn't have the coronavirus, it would have been something else that finally broke U.S.-Chinese relations, which, let's face it, were not in a good place even beforehand. We of course, had the decoupling of the economies. We had increasing militarization in and around East Asia, where both parties, in my opinion, have enough blame to go around. You have growing political and nationalistic rhetoric on both sides. So coronavirus hit, and but it's a little bit like during the Vietnam War, we used to talk about plea coups, a streetcar would come around again. And I think we're in a very similar situation with this. If it wasn't coronavirus, it would be something else.
Yeah, so you would think this was basically inevitable, that, for structural reasons, that we were basically headed for this.
Yeah, I mean, it's very unclear to me how much of this is structural, how much this is political elites, because I think there's a lot of, I'm going to use the term groupthink, and that's maybe too strong of a term, but there's a lot of kind of received wisdom in both the U.S. foreign policy making establishment and the Chinese foreign policy making establishment over what the other side is, does, and looks like. And I think at a time when the balance of power, the distribution of power was shifting, that overlaid some pre-existing tendencies and has contributed to this problem. I don't think it was bound to be in conflict. I think because there's large ocean barriers between the two states, they have long had economic ties together. It's not clear either side would benefit from increased geopolitical tensions in security terms in any way, that this is a structural conflict. But I do think that structure and agency intersect here, with coronavirus just, the cherry on top.
Well, I want to dig down a little further on that structural question,
sure.
Because the other thing that's been coming up a lot is the question of whether coronavirus has been highlighting structural weaknesses or strengths. I mean, so the basic story, right, is that the U.S. Has done really badly, and that highlights not just that the Trump administration is feckless, but that we have structural weaknesses. The Chinese have done a lot better, and people are talking about sort of the strengths of the authoritarian model. And so, your own research background is sort of in the rise and fall of great powers, and I'm wondering what you think. Can we actually infer much from the response to coronavirus?
No. I'll draw a really bad analogy. In the 1930s, we spoke about the effectiveness of autocracies, of communism meeting the challenges of modern times, right? This was obviously a response to the combination of World War I and the following Great Depression. And everyone thought autocracies, fascism was the wave of the future. And that clearly didn't pan out very well. Thankfully so, by the way, I should add. When we talk about the Chinese response to coronavirus, we should be very clear what we're talking about. China was more effective than the United States at suppressing the initial wave of infections. And it did so, and I want to emphasize two points there. It did so at massive violations of what we would regard as necessary civil liberties and civil rights. So if you want to argue effectiveness, what we're really saying is they were more effective at combating a health issue by taking it by sacrificing other things of interest in the first place. And then in the second place, we want to emphasize it's the first wave. We still do not know how this pandemic will shake out. It is clear that the US has not done a very good or effective job at managing the health aspects of coronavirus in the first wave. Whether it will prove more effective in the long term, whether China will prove more effective in the long term, I am reasonably convinced that at a time such as now, when there is a massive global health emergency, no country will be seen as performing "quote unquote" well. It'll be how poorly did they do and at what cost.
If we exempt New Zealand, I think, which appears to be a very special case because they're so far away from everybody. But I think
it turns out isolated, wealthy and well-educated countries that can close borders pretty easily can manage this pretty well.
If you look at the data, though, you're right. I mean, China has had cases ticking back up. Just a factoid I saw a few days ago, as Florida reopened Disney World, you know, where there are like 450,000 coronavirus cases in the state, Hong Kong Disneyland was shut down again because there were 42 cases in Hong Kong. And so they're perhaps taking more aggressive steps, but the case numbers are still ticking up again. So we really can't say that they sort of handled coronavirus and it's now gone.
Yeah, many other countries have taken more aggressive stances to combat coronavirus. It has caused the public health crisis to be shorter in immediacy, and it has come at other sacrifices. It's not better or worse, it's just different. And it's a question of what one is willing to sacrifice.
Is it indicative, though, of, you know, from my point of view, I sort of look at it and say, well, it's indicative of an America where our policy apparatus is very good at doing certain things, you know, having a large military, for example.
Right.
It's not particularly good at handling unconventional crises or unconventional threats.
That's correct. I mean, the U.S. government has traditionally, longstanding, not been designed to be highly regulatory in a European sense, or in a deep state sense, as President Trump often comments upon. You know, think about it in this term. We did not, you know, we could talk about the 9/11 attacks as a failure of internal governance as well. And we have the 9/11 Commission report, right? And what does that show? It shows at the most macro level that the U.S. government doesn't regulate what goes on inside its borders terribly well at the federal level. We defer quite heavily to the states. And we see the consequences of that, for better and for worse, with the varied responses to the coronavirus.
So let's, I guess, move on from coronavirus, because as you say, so much is yet to be determined on that front.
Like the French Revolution.
Yes, exactly. We're still working out what's going on there. But I think the question of sort of U.S.-China relations has become an issue more broadly. There's been a lot of other developments. I assume you probably saw Mike Pompeo's speech a couple of weeks back.
I did. I
particularly enjoyed the description of one commenter on Twitter, which was, it was an orgy of misplaced Cold War nostalgia. And so I wanted to talk to you, I guess, about that idea, that the Trump administration seems to be trying to replay the Cold War. And that seems to be what they view the U.S.-China relationship as.
I agree with that. I mean, I think I'll make two points here. Number one, U.S. policymakers in the Trump administration and beyond have really just adopted a Cold War mindset on this thing. And I'll go further. They haven't just adopted a Cold War mindset. They are trying to create a Cold War so they can apply that mindset. And I would argue it is not just the Trump administration. The Biden administration, from public declarations, seems to be, if anything, more hawkish or as hawkish on China than the Trump administration. After all, we remember that famous Biden campaign ad where he castigates President Trump for not being harsh enough on China in the early stages of the coronavirus outbreak. Not, you know, I want to move on from coronavirus as well, as just an example of this kind of burgeoning DC consensus that China is to be treated like the Soviet Union or like a new Soviet Union. And I think this is frankly irresponsible. I do not think the data supports this argument. I think it is misguided. And above all, which no policymaker is able to answer at this point, and in this case, I'm going to call it magical realism, is if one begins a new Cold War, where does that go? We know how the last one ended, but we don't really appreciate, or at least the policymaking establishment doesn't seem to appreciate, how much contingency went into the end of the Cold War, the prior Cold War, as it evolved. American policymakers now, both the left and the right, seem to believe that if the U.S. just competes hard enough, never mind that people don't define what competition means, that if the U.S. just competes hard enough, that China will surrender, will fall, will implode. You know, it's kind of unclear, that causal process. It goes into this magical box where, you know, fairies are dancing or gremlins are doing their thing, and then out comes another American victory. And when you ask the follow-on question, what if you give a Cold War and you lose? They kind of just stare at you. Not only is your observation that there is a new Cold War mindset emerging, it is irresponsible and it is untethered from strategic reality, in my opinion.
You know, I think the point about agency is a really good one. And, you know, it's one of the cases that I've always just found most fascinating is the fall of the Berlin Wall. You know, and Mary Elise Surratt has done some really great work on this. And
yes.
I have just been fascinated, you know, when I read her work, to find out that basically the reason why the border guards, the night the wall came down, the reason why the border guards didn't open fire was because one guy, a border guard, decided, hey, maybe I'll just let them through the border. And that's basically the reason the wall came down. And you can point to a dozen other examples through the Cold War where contingency and agency really made a difference. It doesn't mean it was necessarily, you know, it didn't cause everything. Structural factors were important too. But as you say, you can't necessarily assume that if you get in this kind of competition with China, that the US is necessarily going to come out on top, just because we don't know what's coming down the pipe.
Right. So there are two different issues there, right? Number one is it's not clear that one can manage an intense superpower competition like another Cold War in peaceful ways. We know how the first one went, but as you just pointed out, there's lots of contingency. So one question is, can you manage it peacefully along the way? Then the second question is, even if the process is peaceful, is the ultimate result what you want it to be? And in that regard, I think it's worth pointing out that people like Mary, people like Jeffrey Engel, people like Melvin Loeffler, people like Mark Trachtenberg have shown compellingly that no one really knew, even into the 1980s, how this darn Cold War competition was going to go. Indeed, people were preparing for continued Cold War competition with the Soviet Union into the 21st century. And so before the American policymaking establishment, and I'm harping on the American policymaking establishment since I don't speak to the Chinese foreign policymaking establishment, although I would certainly harp on it on that side as well. I would just say that the American foreign policymaking establishment doesn't seem to want to grapple with the reality of what new Cold War really would entail. They're trying to give a party, and it's not clear they actually want the party they're going to get.
So I want to follow up sort of on two things here. The first one is I want to just start with the idea of sort of structural strengths and weaknesses, because I feel like a lot of this discussion is basically people looking at the US and looking at China in comparative sense, and basically saying, well, the US is in sort of a stronger position. And that means that we would probably come out on top in this kind of competition. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
Is the U.S. in a stronger position, and therefore, is it likely to win, so to speak?
Yeah. Well, are we in a stronger position as people assume when it comes to China? Because I think there's a lot of sort of talk, particularly in D.C., that if we just sort of turn the might of the U.S. government and turn it away from counterterrorism, we turn it towards China, you know, then we're basically good to go.
I mean, it's hard to do the net assessment. Let me just offer kind of how I see what I see as the offsetting strengths and weaknesses. I mean, obviously, the U.S. is in a much more advantageous geographic position than China, which is obviously on the Asian mainland and is ringed in by capable neighbors to the north and the southwest, and then island moats, and then island competitors across offshore. Geography doesn't do China any advantages to a degree. It helps the U.S. By implication. Population-wise, obviously, China is more demographically eclectic than the United States. Excuse me, it's larger than the United States, but of course, it has a lower per capita GDP. That per capita GDP has been trickling upwards. So over time, it is not inconceivable that China's economy will swamp the United States, even in terms of mobilizable resources. Right now, though, the U.S. seems to have more mobilizable wealth, as some people like to point out. The U.S. military maintains important edges against the PRC, though, as people like the RAND scholars at the RAND Corporation, CSBA, and beyond indicate, the advantages are not what they used to be, maybe waning in some arenas. I'm not an expert on technological and military development in that way, but it seems very plausible that the U.S. will retain some strengths and lose some areas of advantage over time. The U.S. does have a lot of allies. It's not a matter of historical legacy, and the U.S. can afford to sacrifice some, in contrast to what some in D.C. seem to believe. But the flip side of it is geography does tend to drive other countries into the United States' camp more than vice versa. The bottom line is, I think the U.S. has important strengths. I think on the net, in terms of seeking its own security, it's in a very strong position to do just fine, even if China rises. I have a harder time, though, to go to your original question, figuring out how that relates to the U.S. ability to quote unquote win against the PRC. Because frankly, we now look back at the prior Cold War and say, oh, the U.S. has such and such advantages. Obviously, it was bound to win. Well, it wasn't obvious at the time. And so that should give us great circumspection nowadays in terms of going, well, we have A, B, and C advantages, ergo, we're going to win. Well, if we didn't know back then what advantages were going to contribute to our win, even what those advantages were, I think we should be very skeptical of claims that if the U.S. just turns its full might upon the PRC, that the U.S. will somehow dominate this competition. The U.S. can be secure despite this competition. It's not clear it can win because I don't think anyone knows what elements are conducive to quote unquote winning against other great powers in the modern age.
Never mind the point you made earlier that I don't know what winning looks like in this context. You can make some pretty good arguments that regime collapse in Moscow was perhaps not the best thing in the long run for the U.S. And it went pretty okay, in terms of internal domestic stability in Russia.
That's right. It's not, to your point, I do not know what competition with China is designed to produce. Competition, by its very definition, is a process. It is not clear what the outcome of that process is supposed to be. And if you were to survey folks in DC, I'm sure they would say things like, oh, it's a China that accepts the US role in the world, or it's a China that has regime change. But again, what those mean in practice, that's where the real meat comes in. And so I am very skeptical of these claims that the US can quote unquote win, because I don't know what winning looks like. And I don't think anyone knows what elements are conducive to winning, even if one can give a good definition.
Well, one of the more interesting things about the Pompeo speech last week was that he made a concerted effort not just to sort of say this is a new Cold War, but also to highlight the role of ideology. And rather than, even pulling, as some people have done, saying, oh, well, China's authoritarian and it's an axis of authoritarians that's the ideological challenge, Pompeo basically said, hey, they're communists again, and it's another ideological struggle between capitalism and communism. And it just seems to me like I don't really see this ideological frame sticking. It's just not particularly convincing.
No, I think it's laughable, frankly. Mr. Pompeo's argument would have to be the following. China got rich by being Marxist. I think that doesn't fly in the face of his own accusations of Chinese firms, keep in mind, firms, not government, stealing U.S. intellectual property. So either his definition of Marxism is divorced from what Marxism traditionally meant, or he's just pulling this out of his tuchus.
Yeah, I think, you could make arguments about Chinese state capitalism as a model, the sort of the kleptocratic state that we see in China, but none of that is communism. So I think at the very least, Pompeo's ideological comparison is a bit weak.
No, you could almost hear him crafting the speech with the Fox News septuagenarian audience in mind. With apologies to those listening who are over the age of 70. Obviously, that doesn't apply to everyone.
I think the less said about Mike Pompeo's presidential ambitions, the better.
Maybe
that provides us with sort of a way to segue into our last topic, because as you mentioned briefly earlier, the other big outcome of the coronavirus crisis seems to be that we are far more likely to get a Biden presidency than a Trump second term. Obviously, there's a lot of time still to go to the election, but right now it looks like we're probably going to be seeing a Biden foreign policy come January. So I guess, how do you think this is going to impact U.S.-China relations? Are we going to see some improvement, or are things just going to keep getting worse?
Well, I see very little indication that many people in the Democratic foreign policy establishment, separate from the wholesale U.S. government foreign policy establishment, I see that the majority of those around Mr. Biden, and I want to emphasize majority because there is variation, seem to be on board with the Trump administration's approach to this. We have to remember that back when Trump's national security strategy came out in late 2017, the one thing that people in the Democratic side really applauded was the declaration that there's a new era of great power competition. And if we assume that that was a sincere statement, then those people, once in office, will embrace this idea of competition. Indeed, we see discussions emerging over how Biden will compete with China more effectively. or how Mr. Biden will be able to leverage American allies more. Never mind that American allies in the U.S. may or may not have totally simpatico interests on the Chinese question. I see no evidence that there is any call for defense budget cuts, return to diplomacy with China, calls for a return to the engagement strategy, whatever that meant, of prior administrations. So I think this is the hemlock of the arsenal.
I mean, it seems to be a question of methods versus motivation, right?
Correct.
That many in the Democratic establishment are extremely upset about the methods that Trump is using, or perhaps to be clearer, about the incompetence with which Trump is pursuing competition with China, but they don't actually mind about the overall approach. They just want to do it more competently.
Correct. Or what they define as competence. They want a competition with China done through multilateral means, broadly speaking, emphasizing a mobilizing a coalition against the PRC, but and run more effectively than the Trump administration, as you said, more efficiently with fewer hiccups or cross-competing messages. There's no desire that I can tell to walk back competition with China or avoid a competition with China. We are in a race to the bottom when it comes to competition, where each party is trying to outflank the other and being more hawkish on the PRC.
Well, that is not exactly a positive note to end on, but I'm afraid we've run out of time. So thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
And thanks again to our production team, Tyler Shanahan, Cecil Sherman, and Lauren Sander. Thanks to everyone for listening. And if you want to continue the conversation, you can find us on Twitter @PowerProblems or leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts.